Seton Hall has served notice. The Pirates are back. St. John's isn't quite there after losing to a third-ranked team this season, and now it begs the question, does St. John's deserve to be ranked? The short answer is no. UConn is ranked and flexed on Illinois again. They own the Fighting Illini, and they own MSG in the non-con too, and the Huskies are only going to get better as long as they stay healthy. Welcome to another episode of the Tri-State College Basketball Podcast. My name is Brian Dinovellis. Dave Popkin, the longtime radio voice and color commentator for Seton Hall men's basketball, will be my guest. We will talk about these surprising Pirates and their successful third-place finish in the Maui Classic. Dave is standing by, but first, I want to thank my sponsor. The Tri-State College Basketball Podcast is sponsored by Mike Supa of RE/MAX Revolution. If you're looking to buy or sell a home down the Jersey Shore in Monmouth or Ocean Counties, get in touch with Mike Supa of RE/MAX Revolution. Give him a call, 201-988-2577, and tell Mike that Brian sent you from the Tri-State College Basketball Podcast. And it is my pleasure to welcome back to the Tri-State College Basketball Podcast a friend of mine, a friend of the podcast, Dave Popkin, color commentator and play-by-play announcer of Seton Hall men's basketball. Dave, all three games, you're on the call in Maui. Aloha, my friend. Happy Thanksgiving. How's it going?
Aloha. Good to be back. It's going great. Seton Hall is 7-1. They're a fun group to be around, obviously playing well. They could have, maybe should have won the tournament. We'll go all into the nitty-gritty on that. But I think, you know, the people that picked them last in the Big East are probably questioning that decision right now. Yeah. I would say at worst, they're a middle-of-the-pack Big East team. Maybe better. They look good. They have a lot of the elements that you need to be a solid team. Good point guard, two good centers, and potentially three soon. And a lot of other pieces, scorers, you know, some guys that can shoot, good defenders. So Shaw seems to like this team.
He likes them and they like him, right? It's a complete 180 from last year. And Dave, it just goes to show you in this day and age of NIL, you know, no matter what the your budget is, if you find the right pieces, the pieces that fit you and they buy in, then you can rebuild very quickly.
That fit you and fit each other. I think that it was always hard to do because before it was just like playing time and acclaim, the higher scorers, the higher rebounders, you know, the people getting all the stats get all of those things. But now it's money, right? So yeah. If you play more minutes and you score more points, you're probably going to get more money. And it's hard to get the kids to buy in, I'd imagine, to, hey, you're going to play the same amount of minutes as everybody else on the team. You're going to play 22 minutes and you're going to score 10 points. And that makes the team more versatile and we're going to win. I think if you do that with some of the older guys, like an AJ Staten McCray, people that are in their last year of eligibility, that's an easier sell, right? Because they're not going for another NIL deal after this. And they, especially him, lost at Miami last year. I'm sure it was excruciating to be there as it was to be at Seton Hall. So if the coach says, hey, we're going to win, you're going to be a big part of it. And, you know, you're going to be in the New York market. I think it's something to sell. And that Shaw seems to have found the right pieces, as you've said, that are willing to go along with all that.
Yeah, they do. And you said it too. You said the word fun, right? Last year, you've been around this team, what, 23? This is your 23rd or 24th year? I'm losing track, Dave.
23rd, yeah.
23rd year. You know, I've been around this team since 1988 in some way, shape, or form. I've watched them play. And last year, without question, was the worst in our lifetime of being around the Pirates. They're fun. They're a group that really is connected defensively and offensively. What has surprised you the most about this team, other than their record?
I would say the play of Mike Williams. I didn't know a lot about him coming in, and he seems to be one of the most important, if not the most important player on the team right now, because he's gotten them off to great starts. His energy defensively, he wants to step up and take a big shot. He just provides that intangible junkyard dog kind of thing that Shaw likes. And it was a huge step for him after cramping up and having knee issues the first game against NC State and then playing limited minutes the next game against USC. Somehow, third straight day, even though it's, all the heat in Hawaii and all this, he stepped up and played 32 minutes and played great and kind of pushed through whatever he was going through, dehydration or whatever. So I think he's been a really important player for this team. He can also, it seems, serve as a backup point guard if the other guys get in foul trouble, as they did the last game. If Clark and Parker are out or limited, Williams seems like he can handle the ball. So that's been, a pleasant surprise for me. I've talked to Shaw about it. It wasn't a surprise to him at all. He was like, listen, this guy was in the SEC. He's a good player. And he's just starting to blossom. He's been given the opportunity, he's been given the right coaching.
There you go. Given the opportunity. I mean, at LSU, I don't know who he was behind, but he's been given that opportunity here. And I think this was a coming out party for him. He had some moments in the non-con against Monmouth a little bit, and you saw glimpses, but now suddenly Pirate fans are saying, whoa, I didn't know about Mike Williams. And he's their best defender. I mean, he's doing it on both sides. He is guarding the other team's best player.
He often is, and Fisher is too. Elijah Fisher was noted for his scoring at the last couple stops. He was a double-figure scorer for DePaul on some shaky teams. He was a big scorer at Pacific last year, over 15 a game at the D1 level, pretty good conference. And he has come in and been an important part of their defense as well. They put him on Darian Williams, who is an All-American, I think, for NC State in the first game. Kept him to half of his average. I mean, it wasn't Fisher on him every possession, but he was on him a lot, and he can kind of guard multiple positions. Very often he is the head of the snake on the full court press, and this team has pressed a lot more than I've ever seen. I think they press more than any Seton Hall team that I've seen, and I go back almost as far as you because I was doing the games at Miami when they were in the Big East. So some of the PJ and Blaney teams and all that. So and he usually is like first on the press and guarding the ball and kind of running around trapping and stuff. So he's been an important part of the defense. And really, I mean, you look up and down, Payne and Hines in the middle, I mean, have helped Seton Hall be one of the top five shot blocking teams in the country, and others have helped contribute in that realm as well. Their steals are way up from last year. So the whole group has gelled defensively.
Yeah, that's a good point. Averaging every game, they've had over 9 steals a game. It's not just turning you over. The way that I watch them defensively, the way they fight through every screen, there's no switching, right? They're fighting through every screen. That's their MO. They make you work on offense, and when they turn you over, they're getting easy buckets at the other end. So this defensive team, how do you compare them to any other defensive team that you've seen in Seton Hall?
No, they're different. I mean, I think Gonzo tried to do this, tried to kind of run and jump and trap and whatever, but those teams weren't as athletic and as disciplined as this group is. I think a lot of times teams say they want to press, they say they want to run, and then they pull back because they're not efficient doing it. But this team gets turnovers and they get you out of your offense, and then when you get into the half court, they're able to scheme it so that they take the best player on the other team out, or at least they reduce them to half of what they normally score. Like Ace Glass in the last game for Washington State. He had just come off 40, and he was averaging 33 in the tournament, and they held him under 20, and he was kind of quiet doing that. And this is a guy who one of the other coaches, in the tournament that I talked to, said that he's a young Damian Lillard. Okay, that he's going to be a good NBA player, like a very good NBA player. And he's a true freshman. So the kid can score, and I think Seton Hall held him to like 13 or 15 points, something like that. So they know what they're doing. I think the rebounding is a can improve. There's been a couple games where the rebounding's been weak, but by and large, I mean, defensively, they're holding teams below their average. Coming into the last game, they were fourth in the country in scoring defense. I get that's only through 7 games, but I would expect that to continue.
Yeah, they did it with defense. They did it by pounding you, points in the paint. Will Wade, let's take these in order. The NC State game, that was the game that really caught the attention of America, if you will, and really caught the attention of Seton Hall fans. They were like, okay, we're 5-0, but who have we played? Boom. That game, Dave, what impressed me the most was how they took control of the game. They impose their will, and anytime you were on the edge of your seat saying, "Ah, is NC State going to make a run?" There was never a run. It never got under nine, and Seton Hall really controlled it from start to finish. That's at least what impressed me the most. How about you?
Totally. I asked Ryan Whalen in the pregame interview, what's your strategy for NC State? He said, punch him in the mouth.
Oh,
And I think that is pretty much, the way that they're going about this
okay.
right now is that they want to jump people. They want to play from ahead because they have a point guard that can manage the team and manage the lead. Bud Clark did a great job of that. NC State was one of his better games. And then he stepped up and had his best game against USC. Had 18 points, 7 assists in that one, and really started to not only look for his own shot, but know how to manage the clock. And I thought he had a great tournament, in addition to several other Pirates. But yeah, I mean, NC State, they jumped out in front and they were never really challenged in the game. I mean, there's one little run, there right before halftime that NC State had that made it, a bit of a game. But other than that, the Pirates were in control against a ranked team. What does that mean at this point of the year? Like, had NC State played anybody? Not really. Are they going to be a ranked team in 3 weeks? I don't know. Probably not. But it's a high major team and a team that's probably going to be in the top half of their conference, a team that's going to be in the conversation with like an All-America player on it. So it's a good win. Like, I'm not
Awesome.
downplaying it. I'm not saying it's the biggest win of all time. It's a neutral court game, right? You're not winning at NC State. I thought it was a great win, because of the way they did it. They jumped out to the huge lead and then never trailed.
Yeah, and I think at the end of the year, is if the numbers, stay similar, that will go down as a quad one win, right? Let's wait for the NET rankings to come out, neutral site win. If NC State, wins the games they're going to, that will go down as a quad one win. The USC game, I mean, let's just begin with the controversy, Dave. You're sitting courtside. Did you see what everyone else in America saw, that Seton Hall got an unfavorable whistle in this one?
I
Maybe an
did.
all-time unfavorable whistle.
Yeah, I did. And I asked Shaheen about it on the post game show. And I just led with, USC shot 20 more free throws than you did. Do you have any comment on that? And he was like, I don't want to get in trouble. What do you think? And I was like, I thought you got jobbed.
Okay, yep.
So I mean, it's hard because you've done this job. So I'm sitting courtside. So the Stephon Payne ghost foul in the far corner. Is I've got 10 people between me and that call. So it's hard for me to know without a monitor, and they didn't give us a monitor. Okay.
You're
So
not seeing replays?
no.
Really?
At some of these places, they don't provide it.
Oh,
I
so
mean, there's
this
such
happened
slippage in
before.
these venues, man. Like, I'm providing my own stat monitor on my laptop. I get no replay monitor. So Matt Ambrose pulled it up on some of the calls because he was doing the game with me, and he's the SID, and he
Okay.
kind of see it. So, we saw some of the stuff 10, 20, 50 seconds after the fact. I mean, the Payne one looked like just an anticipatory ref whistle that was a bad call. Like, I didn't see a foul there at all. And in a one possession game, it crushes you. And then the baseline one where the ball goes out of bounds seemed to go off USC. Shaheen had called his last time out like 30 seconds before that to set up a play and couldn't challenge because he didn't have any timeouts. And the officials at that point now cannot challenge it in the last 2 minutes because they want the games to go fast and they don't want to cut off whatever the next game is on TV, which is a mistake because you need to be able to get the call right. I mean, if the other officials think that the guy along the baseline blew it and they saw something else, they either need to come in and change it or go to the monitor so they can change it, even if the coach doesn't have a challenge. So that changed the complexion of the game. And then there was another one that was right in front of us where it looked like a jump ball.
Yes.
Baker Mazzara was giving a verbal timeout, timeout, timeout. I could see it, and the ref saw it. Like, he couldn't make a T sign because he was on the ball. But two Seton Hall players were also on the ball at the
Correct.
same time he was calling timeout. So, if two of those three go Seton Hall's way, they win the tournament. They win the game and they win the tournament. So, it was very frustrating. I mean, at one point, Seton Hall had taken no free throws or a really low amount, and USC had taken like 19 free throws.
Yeah, I think in the second half at one point it was Seton Hall had not taken one free throw and USC had taken 14 or 15 in the second half. And as you know, Ezra Osor, the big man, outshot Seton Hall at the free throw line 19 to 18, which I have never seen in all my years. And Jay Billis, of all people, who we know how he feels about the Big East, Jay Billis, of all people, said he had never seen that.
Yeah, I talked to, I'm not going to say which team, a coach after that game, a coach that was in that tournament.
Okay.
Okay. And
Bobby Hurley?
nope.
Oh, okay. I took a
But
shot.
the coach said it was the second worst officiated game that he had seen.
Really?
So
Okay.
whatever that means.
I'll tell you what the first worst officiated game you'd ever seen was.
I can't disclose
I
because
knew you're
then
I'm
that
trying,
gives it away.
Dave.
That gives it away. But
Right, I'm trying.
yeah, but the point is like that they weren't Big East refs and they called the game really close and they made a lot of anticipatory calls and it started to pile up. And Shaheen said on the post game show, "These guys don't know us. They don't know the way we play." And Seton Hall is very physical on every possession. So it's like holding in football. If you really looked hard enough, you could call holding on every play in football. You could
Yeah.
probably call pass interference on every play in football. So if you do that, it mucks the game up and people don't enjoy it. And if you have a parade to the free throw line where you don't let the guys play any defense, it mucks the game up and it favors a skilled, good free throw shooting team like USC. And I mean, Asar is a big man that Seton Hall didn't really have an answer for. I mean, let's face it, this guy has got to be a big on NIL money player. I mean, he was impressive. He looked like an NBA player to me. And no matter what they did, I mean, I don't know if they were messing up their pick and roll coverage or if they just didn't have anybody that could stay with him, like if the big guys couldn't stay with him, but he would drive by them. He was posting up, he was rebounding. I mean, the kid was a stud. So did he earn a lot of those fouls? I'm sure that he did, but there were some that were like head scratchers, like, hardly touched him.
Yeah, it seemed like every time down court, Seton Hall, it was not if, but when they were going to be called for a whistle. But Dave, I'll just say this in conclusion about the game. A couple things. Number one, definitely top three worst officiated games I've seen in Seton Hall. Number one would have been the semifinal of the Big East tournament against Marquette. It was a James Breeding game. The triple overtime loss to Creighton at home comes to mind. A lot of butchered calls there, but listen, at some point you have to overcome the officials and find a way to adapt. Seton Hall didn't, USC did. Credit them, they win the tournament, but I think Seton Hall won a lot of hearts across the country. A lot of people took notice of this. It's not going to go down as a bad loss. I think USC will be in the top 25 and may be there to stay. So in the end, a tough competitive game and a learning lesson, I guess, for Seton Hall.
Yeah, and it's a good point that you made, and I think Shaw made it after the game as well. No matter how they're blowing the whistle, you need to adapt. You need to change within the game, and sometimes, just change your MO. And you're right about, the rankings. I mean, if they win the game, yes, it certainly helps them because that's a top 30 KenPom team. But even with the 2-point loss against a good team like that on a neutral court, and the two other wins, I think they jumped 31 points in the KenPom in 3 days. They went up from like 90 something to 61.
Yeah.
And so then if you win a couple of, these games coming up, like at Kansas State or the Villanova game, a couple of these, good KenPom net type of games, then you're in the NCAA tournament conversation, right? If you can fight your way into the 30s and the 40s here pretty soon, and then you start to play the UConns and St. John's and
Yeah.
Creighton and you get your opportunities, certainly going to help your strength of schedule.
Concluding this tournament, We've talked about the defense. The defense has, it's one of the top 20 defenses in the country in defensive efficiency, points allowed per game, block shots. They were number one in the country for a while. I don't know if they still are. How about the offense? Does the offense need a little more credit? They shot over 50% in all three of these games. I don't know if they can keep it up, but that's a pretty impressive stretch for any Seton Hall team.
Did they shoot 50% in three games all of last year? I'm not sure if they did.
You might have had to combine both games, 26% plus 27. Oh, there's 50%. Wrong.
Yeah, no, I mean, you're right. I mean, they've been efficient. I mean, I can count on one hand the bad shots that they took in that tournament. And a lot of them were, hey, we're up 10 late. Let's just take a wild three just for the heck of it. With it, they're playing within the flow. There were early in the year too many shot clock violations. Like it was taking them a little long to get into the offense. But I think they have good flow in that there were a lot of live ball turnovers those last couple games, and they were able to get out on the break and get some easy points. Okay, so that takes pressure off of your half court offense because you're not having to grind it out every single time. And these guys have proven that they are efficient on the break. They can throw lobs for dunks. They're looking for each other and not, just taking it selfishly to the basket if they're double teamed, stuff like that. And then within the half court, they share it. Sometimes they're one of the slower teams in the country in terms of tempo because they do run a lot of clock. But if you do what we were talking about earlier, where you're building a double digit lead, that becomes an asset because you're playing smart math and you're used to playing slow at that point. It's not something different, right? You're not going down in the first half, taking a shot in 10 seconds, and then all of a sudden you have to learn how to take 28 seconds to run the possession. If you're running 28 seconds all the time, you're just doing what you do at the end of the game, right? You're not having to learn something else to manage the lead. So I think that they've been smart with that. And yes, I mean they have better shooters. Staton McRae is a legit 3-point shooter. We haven't seen a lot of Bud Clark's 3-point shooting. We saw it early on, like the first game or two, he had a couple threes, and we haven't seen any of it since. So I'm not sure what that is. But Simpkins been a great scorer off the
Yes,
bench.
love him.
Over 12 points, and he's a versatile guy too. He can handle it a little bit, and he plays good defense.
Yeah, and Mike Williams, you have three. Last year, you didn't have one. You didn't have one 3-point shooter. I'm not saying these are great 3-point shooters, but if AJ Staton McRae, Tawan Simpkins, and Mike Williams, I think we've seen three capable, more than capable 3-point shooters. What about inside? How about this inside combination before we get to the Big East a little bit of Najai Hines and Stephen Payne, and we haven't even seen God's Will Arian.
I mean, hopefully Gods will be back sometime in December. He stayed back and got some rehab from Tony Testa and with some of the other injured players as well. But it seems like Gods will is closer to returning than the others. Obviously, Jassim Felton is out for the year with the ACL. But Gods will was the starting center last year. He seemed to be showing signs of promise. If he can stay healthy, I know he's had some, foot issues, I think both feet, in his career. He's a great kid. He seems to be coachable. Gives you a third option where if what happened in, I don't know if it was the last game or two games ago when both Payne and Hines had like three and four fouls and they had to sit and he was playing Josh Rivera at the five, who's like 6'5", 6'6", in that range. And the lead started to slip away. You definitely need a God's Will or somebody else like that to give you another body and give you some more fouls in the middle and another shot blocker. I mean, he's really long, 7 foot type guy. I think Hines has been inconsistent, but when he is good, I think he's the best Seton Hall big man I've seen. I mean, in a long time. I mean, he's like Angel Delgado was a beast and he did what he did, right? He was a better rebounder than Hines. He was like he was ferocious, but he wasn't a huge shot blocker and he couldn't like run the court and fill a lane on the fast break. And he wasn't gonna like, I mean,
He didn't have a
Hines.
variety of offensive low post moves like Hines does. That's what's
Hines
really
has
impressive.
crisp footwork, good hands. He's a willing passer. The double team comes to him. He's looking over the top, who to pass to. He has good basketball IQ. The guys seem to like him. He's got a good personality. I mean, I saw an NBA scouting report recently. I forget the guy's name, or I would give him credit. But he said, probably not this year, but next year he could be a first round pick.
Wow. I didn't think of them on that level, but that's pretty high.
Yeah, there were 25 different teams at the Maui Invitational that had scouts there. I'm sure it wasn't just for him. There were a lot of top players there, but and then Payne has been terrific. He has good hands as well. Doesn't turn the ball over, shot blocker, doesn't like demand the ball, but if you give it to him, he can do something with it. I think that the flow that they have where Payne starts, and if he's off to a great start, you ride him for a while. And if not, or he's in foul trouble, you put Hines in and you have that great luxury.
Yeah, Seton Hall has never had this in a long time. Two centers, right? The days of, Eugene Teague or Angel Delgado or Herb Pope being their only big man inside and nobody to back them up. Now they have two, maybe three on the way. Dave, you called Najai Hines the best big man you've seen in a long time. I'm going to go back to the days of Mark Bryant. Najai Hines is the most skilled offensive Seton Hall big man as a freshman since Mark Bryant. Luther Wright didn't have this. Sam Dallenberg didn't have this skill set. Angel Delgado, as good as he was as a freshman, he didn't have this plethora of low post moves that we have seen in Najai Hines.
Yeah, and now you just have to see, like, he'll have games, Hines, where he has 2 points, and then he has games where he'll have 12 points.
That's
He'll have games where he
freshman.
has 7 blocks, and he'll have games where he has 1 block. And sometimes it's matchups, or he's, who knows? They played 3 straight games, and that's a lot, for a big man to play. That's, something you don't do very often except the Big East tournament, and a tournament like this. So I think as you spread these games out and you give them a little bit more coaching and time to recover, that you're going to start to see big things.
Listen, this team, you think it's going to get better. They have a test coming up and they will have Central Connecticut, which upset Rutgers, which is off to a very good start this year. Central Connecticut beat Boston College, so Shaheen Holloway will have their attention of the players. Then it's at Kansas State. They get a week off and it's Rutgers. Best case, Dave, I don't think any Pirate fan had this team 10-1. You win three of those, you're 10-1 going into your Big East opener against Providence. That would be surprising, but it's there now for the taking for Seton Hall.
I think if they didn't go 9-2, it'd be a big disappointment at this point, the way that they're playing. 10-1, I think, is a fair expectation. It's hard to win on the road against a team like Kansas State. They have a guy, Abdi Bashir from Monmouth that beat them last year in Newark, and is a good scorer, and they have other pieces. They have high major type athletes on that team. So, who knows? Who knows on a game like that? But you would think that their chances in the other games are pretty good. Central Connecticut has two good forwards, Darren Smith and Max Frazier, but you have to have good guard play against Seton Hall, or you're going to get run out of the building because they're going to press you, they're going to turn you over, they're going to drive by you. So I don't know a lot about the Central guards. They seem to have more athletes than most NEC teams. Like they seem to is like an all airport team where they look good out there on the floor, and they were able to prove that at Rutgers. I'm not sure if their guards can hang with Seton Hall.
Well, they'll certainly have the attention, like I said, of Shaheen Holloway. You have to go 2-1 in those three games. That puts you at 9-2, and that would be above where most fans thought. 10-1, and now maybe you start thinking, okay, maybe this can be an upper half team in the Big East. Dave, before I let you go, want to talk about crashing the boards. If you want to catch Dave Popkin, not only on Seton Hall men's basketball, he also does a podcast, a weekly podcast. You can catch it, I think, on Fox Sports Radio. Tell people about it, Dave, and how's it going? Crashing the boards.
Yeah, it's going great. It's our 3rd year. First 2 years, Austin Johnson, the color commentator for Rutgers Radio, was my partner. He's had to pare back some of his commitments. So I brought on Greg Herrenda, the former FDU coach, to be my co-host. He started to do some stuff for ESPN Plus, FS1, etc. And he's
Love him.
doing the show as well. And he brings a lot of New Jersey history. He's a Jersey guy from North Bergen. And obviously, coached at FDU and coached at Seton Hall as an assistant for George Blaney, recruited Shaheen Holloway and others, Danny Hurley. So he knows, about Jersey basketball, and he's a good friend, and that's been fun. And we air on five Fox Sports Radio New Jersey radio stations Saturdays at 10 a.m. And then they archive it as a podcast if, people want to listen after the fact. But we've had Shaw already, we've had Steve Peichel already. This week we had Dan Calandrillo and Andy Katz on the show.
Okay.
So we try to bring, Grant Billmeyer's been on already this year. We're gonna have King Rice coming up. We talk New Jersey, college basketball, and kind of any Jersey connections, right? So a little bit of Jersey high school, a little bit of Jersey that's gone to the NBA, but it's mostly college basketball. It's a lot of Seton Hall, Rutgers, Princeton, that kind of thing.
Love it. Just another opportunity for our New Jersey area college basketball fans to get more coverage of the teams you root for. Dave, really, really good stuff here. Seton Hall is fun again. Makes your job a lot easier and a lot more fun as well. And it makes the games much more enjoyable for fans like myself. Thanks for coming on, Dave. Always, always great talking to you, my friend.
Thanks, Dino. Talk to you soon.
All right. Always great to talk with Dave Popkin. Catch him on Crashing on the Boards with his podcast, Fox Sports Radio. You can also go to their archives and check out some of those interviews, as he said, and catch him doing play-by-play and color commentating on Seton Hall men's basketball. That tandem, Gary Cohen and Dave Popkin. Gary Cohen and Dave Popkin, 23 years together doing Seton Hall men's basketball. That is a long, long time, a testament to their professionalism and their relationship. So Seton Hall has put themselves in a great, great position. I'm not ready to put this team in the discussion of NCAA tournament teams, not by a long shot, but if they finish this non-con 10-1, then maybe I will start to say, okay, they belong in the discussion. They belong in the discussion. Right now, I would just say, enjoy this ride. It's fun. See where this team goes because it's a heck of a lot better than it was last year. All right, let's go around the tri-state now, and I want to get to some of the other big teams in our area. I want to get to UConn, St. John's, and Rutgers. What a game it was at Madison Square Garden, Storrs South for the UConn Huskies. Once again, they beat up on Illinois. This one was a lot closer than their matchup in the NCAA tournament. There was no 30 to nothing run this time, but it was still a game that UConn took control from the opening tip. It was a lot of solo ball. It was a lot of Alex Caravan early. Solo ball saw the shot go in, and UConn jumped out to a big double-digit lead. But then the lead would grow to 21 in the second half. And then Illinois chipped away. They got hot from the outside for a little bit. UConn went cold. We've seen stretches where UConn does go cold. And they cut it to 7. And under 3 minutes to go, Illinois hits a three. What was once a 21-point lead and a double-digit lead was shrunk to 7. And a big possession and a key moment in this game. If you didn't see it, 2.5 minutes to go, UConn working on a shot clock, and the shot clock was winding down. It was under 10, it was under 8. Alex Caravan drives to the hoop and throws up a wild shot. Did not hit rim. It hit backboard. It caromed right to Eric Ryba, who had a huge, huge offensive rebound. Ryba kicks it out to Malachi Smith, who's 30 feet from the hoop. The shot clock reset. It should not have reset. Malachi Smith alertly has the ball and he heard shoot, shoot. He flings it up and the player for Illinois fouls him. Not only that, the ball goes in. Miraculously, the ball goes in. A 4-point play. The place is going bananas. The officials then take a look at it. And I'm telling you, yes, I'm rooting for UConn, but in my opinion, the shot clock would have expired had it not reset. Riba got that ball with like 2 seconds left on the shot clock, and he kicked it out to Smith, and Smith did not shoot this ball right away. He held it, he dribbled, and then he shot. The shot clock would have expired. There's no doubt in my mind. Go back and look at it. Count the seconds. Do it with a stopwatch. Trust me, it would have expired. At the very least, probably what the official should have done was given the ball to UConn out of bounds. You know, it's not their fault. The shot clock reset. It's not the three officials' fault on the court. And that probably would have satisfied both coaches, although Brad Underwood still would have been upset. You know, UConn gets the ball, side out of bounds, 2 seconds left in the shot clock. They did neither. They counted the basket. UConn had a 4-point play. Malachi Smith had the 4-point play. And that, for all intents and purposes, was game, set, match. UConn went up 11, and Illinois never recovered with 2:10 to play. So UConn got the break. And I'm sure Illinois, you know, can say, well, you know, if that's a shot clock violation, we get the ball, you know, with a chance to cut it to four, to cut it to five. You're right. I'm not sure they win the game anyway, but it certainly would have been a different score in the end. For UConn, score a big one for them. They now have non-conference wins over two ranked teams. Number 13, Illinois. Number 7, BYU. The only loss was at home to number 4, Arizona, who, well, listen, they didn't have Terrace Reed. Okay, things happen. It still counts as a loss. We saw the return of Terrace Reed in this game. Minutes restriction. We saw the debut, the UConn debut of Braylon Mullins. Both players, minutes restrictions. Braylon Mullins had one field goal in this game. I think he shot 1 for 5. He's going to be a player. He is going to be a player, and he has time to get better before the Big East starts. They go at Kansas. They're going to play Florida. They're going to play Texas, plus a bye game against East Texas A&M. 4 games for Braylon Mullins to get better before the Big East regular season starts. He is going to be someone you want to keep an eye on, and was penciled in as a starter before this season started. So we'll see how he's going to fit in and where he's going to get his minutes from. Eric Riba, another star freshman, just keeps getting better and better. Huge offensive rebound. I mean, he just ripped it away from the Illinois player. Had some double-figure games. He's averaging 9 points a game. You can see the offense there. He can hit threes. He is an excellent, excellent offensive big man. I mean, he is exactly what the NBA is looking for. A skilled 7-footer who can shoot, put the ball on the floor, distribute. He's got all the tools offensively. And when you have him and Terrace Reed at full strength, I don't know if there are two better centers in the country than Riba and Terrace Reed when they have it going. The defense is shining. This UConn team is built on defense. They held Illinois to a season-low 61 points. They held Illinois to a season-low from three from the field, 32% from the field, 21% from three, right on their averages. They're below their averages. They're holding opponents to 38% field goal percentage for the season. They're one of the top defensive efficiency teams in the country. Listen, UConn is just, we're just starting to see it. And this game, to beat an Illinois team like this at Madison Square Garden, I think the stat is that UConn has won their last 5 non-conference games at Madison Square Garden. They won by double digits. What's concerning to me, you know, I'd like to see a little more consistency with the offense for 40 minutes. They go through some stretches where they don't score. Every team does it, but it seems like it happens every game. Solo ball, what has happened to his shot? He was one of the best three-point shooters in the country last year at 41%. He hit two early in this game. You're thinking, okay, he's going to get it going. But then he went ice cold, 2 for 10 for the game. I think he's shooting 21% from three for the season. He's 12 for 49. So what's that? That's 25%. Just under 25%, 12 for 49. So he needs to get it right. If Terrace Reed stays healthy, Braylon Mullins improves, and somehow Solo Ball finds his shot, look out. But what you're seeing is this. You are seeing a team that looks a lot like this championship team from 2 years ago with two very good point guards, Silas Demery Jr., Malachi Smith. Malachi Smith could start for a lot of teams in this country. He could start on more than half the teams. He can start on a lot of Power Five teams. He came to UConn knowing his role. He plays it well, had his best game, 14 points, a team high, 9 assists. When you have that type of production out of your backup point guard, and there were times in this game that Demery and Malachi Smith were in the game together. All right. That shows you how much confidence that Dan Hurley has in both guards. When you have production like that from your backup point guard, that is where it's at. Dan Hurley said it afterward. He had high praise for his guards, high praise for Malachi Smith. And when you have guard play like that, you can win. Here's Hurley.
Yeah, I mean it's important. I still think point guard play is it's so critical. I think it looked tonight like it, kind of like the guard play looked that way in 23 and 24. Malachi made a huge difference. A difference to go off the bench with 14 and 9, and to make obviously that. Crazy, crazy three there to really get it back to doubles when we were wavering. I mean, that was, he's the story of the game.
So good for Malachi Smith. His coming out game, he was huge. It shows you the type of veteran. And listen, he's not young. All right, he's going to be 26. Now, personally, I don't think anyone above the age of 25 should be playing college basketball. I really think that they should cap it. But these are the rules, and UConn is all the better for it with this guard duo. So let's see what UConn can do this week. They play Kansas. Kansas may be without their super frosh, Darren Peterson, who's still nursing a hamstring injury. And we know UConn lost there with Cam Spencer and Tristan Newton when I think they were undefeated a couple years ago, and Kansas beat them. I think Cam Spencer had, didn't he have a shot late in that game? A three, a decent look at three to give UConn the lead, as memory serves me correct. But this is a game Kansas will be favored. UConn can win. We'll see if they can go on the road and pick up what would be a huge quad one road opportunity at Fog Allen Fieldhouse. So we'll see what UConn can do. We'll see what St. John's can do because right now they are not winning. They went to Las Vegas with high hopes and they came out with many question marks, going 1-2, nothing short of a disappointment. They have now played three ranked teams this season. They have lost to all three ranked opponents. And it was whether it was Alabama, Iowa State, or Auburn, St. John's could not get the defensive stops when they needed to. And they could not rebound. Their defensive rebounding is poor. They are not a good defensive rebounding team, and they are a below average defensive team. Rick Pitino thinks they're a very average defensive team. And I'm quoting him, they are not locked in like last year. Last year, our guards rebounded, and this is not a locked in defensive team because they are new to each other. They're going to either get it or they're going to continue losing. If there's one coach who can get the defense turned around, it's Rick Pitino. But isn't it amazing how this team is the complete opposite? They're polar opposites from last year. Last year, it was one of the top two defensive teams in the country. It was them or Houston. They had an identity. They were mean. They were nasty. They were in your face. They won games with their defense, and it was their offense that was poor. We know this team can score, but I'm not sure they're a great offensive team. They're a much improved offensive team. Their three-point shooting is very inconsistent, wildly inconsistent, but they can score, and they can score in bunches. So they're better offensively, but they're much worse defensively. They need to get it figured out. And part of the problem, okay, is the way this team was built. Rick Pitino went after offensive players, offensive scorers. That's what happens, right? You go through a season where you don't have a lot of scorers. So what are you going to do? You're going to go out and recruit guys who can score. Well, not only are they trying to figure each other out on both ends and where they all can get their points and get theirs, right? They're human, but they're trying to win and they're not connected defensively and they don't rebound well. That's attention to detail, attention to the scouting report. But here's the bigger picture. Defensively, they're not stopping anyone. They're not stopping anyone at the point of attack. I've said this on another podcast with Mark Zanetto of the Big East Energy Network. I went on his podcast and I said, Dylan Darling, if Dylan Darling is your starting point guard, I don't know if you can win a Big East championship. I said something like that, but my basic point was Rick Pitino went out and recruited this team. He did not recruit a number one point guard. He tried to make Ian Jackson a point guard. He talked about positionless basketball. I didn't buy it at the time. I don't buy it now, and I'll never buy that in college basketball. This isn't the NBA where you have skilled offensive players up and down your roster and 6'11 point forwards who bring the ball up the court and are press breakers and run the offense. Dan Hurley went out this year and knew he had to get a number one point guard. That was his priority. He got two, Silas Demery and Malachi Smith. Shaheen Holloway did not want to go through another season without a point guard and last year's disaster. He went out and got two. He went out and identified Bud Clark and got Trey Parker from NC State. They identified the most important position on the team, the point guard. Rick Pitino did not go out and get a number one point guard. What did he do the last 2 years? 2 years ago, he got Danis Jenkins, number one point guard. Last year, he got Kadari Richmond and Davon Smith, two point guards, two lead guards. How did that work out? Pretty damn well. Dylan Darling, it's not his fault. He comes in with nice numbers. He's a little undersized. I know he's dealing with a hamstring issue, but that all factors in. Dylan Darling was not brought in here to be the number one point guard. He was not. He's become the number one point guard by default because Ian Jackson is turnover prone, cannot run the offense. Chosun Sanin is another one who they tried to make him the point guard. That's not working out. Dylan Darling is the point guard by default. So the other guys need to figure it out and get better. Jackson struggled with ball security. Sanin has found some highs, but many lows. It's been a roller coaster for him. Zubi, Bryce Hopkins, Dylan Mitchell, Ozias Sellers, those have been your four best players. But in your most important position, this is the roster that Rick Pitino built. He shopped for the groceries. It's up to him to make the meal. All right? Cook up something, go back into the kitchen. There's time off in between some of the games up ahead. They've been embarrassed by LeBaron Fylon, by Aiden Holloway, by Taman Lipsey from Iowa State, and they got absolutely torched by Tahad Pettiford. So not only is it not working defensively against lead guards, athletic guards, better guards, but it's not working offensively. Can you win with Dylan Darling? Sure, because there's enough talent around him. But can you be a championship contending team with Dylan Darling? I don't think so. It's not his fault. It's Rick Pitino's, and it's Rick Pitino's job to get it right. St. John's needs to get some wins. They need some wins up ahead. They're playing Ole Miss. There's an opportunity there. They're going to face a pesky Iona team, and there's an opportunity against Kentucky in Georgia. However, these are teams that are not currently ranked, but these are games that are winnable. St. John's cannot afford to lose them, because then you're talking about seeding in the NCAA tournament. Then you're talking about positioning and just morale, and wondering how good or how poor is this team. And let me tell you something, Ole Miss, there's talent. Chris Beard can coach. And St. John's, you know that there's a former St. John's player on that Ole Miss roster named AJ Storr, who's on his fourth team in 4 years. He goes from St. John's to Wisconsin to Kansas and now Ole Miss. He's everything that's wrong with NIL, but he is on that team, and you know he is somehow going to be motivated. So St. John's needs to win that game against Ole Miss at Madison Square Garden. You're at home. Show me something. Lastly, Rutgers showed me something. Rutgers showed their fans something. Rutgers was staring at the possibility of possibly going on a 7-game losing streak. They got embarrassed at home by Central Connecticut. They got run out of Vegas nearly. They got run out of the arena by Tennessee. And Notre Dame had enough in them to beat them. This team was reeling with 3 straight losses. But hallelujah, Steve Peichel and this team got a day off. They got Wednesday off during feast week. They came back on Thanksgiving. They laid an egg in the first half against UNLV, trailing by 6 at the half. But they outscored UNLV by 19 points in the second half. What a second half performance by Rutgers. What a game by Emmanuel Agboole. 21 points, 13 rebounds, both career highs. Dylan Grant was magnificent in this game, 17 and 8. Darren Buchanan Jr. was very good. He is becoming a very nice player out of George Washington. And I'd like to see more from him, because I think he can contribute more to this team. I think Rutgers is going to need him to win games. So a very good performance, a much needed win. And instead of Rutgers coming home reeling on a 4-game losing streak, this team has a little bit of, you know, it made their Thanksgiving turkey taste sweet. All right. They won the rebounding battle in this game. They showed some heart. They showed some grit. They showed what this team can do. There are still many deficiencies. They're not a great scoring team. They're not a great shooting team from three or inside. But if they can play defense and turn you over and get things going in the other direction, they showed what this team can do. And they gave hope. One guy who really, really could be an X factor moving forward, I believe, is Chris Newley. I mean, he is an energy guy off the bench. I don't think you're going to see him in the starting lineup anytime soon, but maybe like last year, right? Maybe like last year when Dylan Grant emerged in January and became a starter, maybe Chris Newley can be that guy. They need more consistency out of Dennis Badilow. I think you're going to see some games where he shoots the ball very well, and then some games where he doesn't. American, he shot the ball very well. He was hot and cold in this tournament, but Chris Newley, if he figures out how to play, how to protect the basketball. The more he gets experience, the more you're seeing a guy who can defend, who can block shots, who can really get up and just provide a spark and give you a glimpse of somebody who has big time athleticism and works hard for his points, and somebody who can develop into a player. I think he's going to be an X factor moving forward. But this win, believe me, Rutgers fans, you know what's coming up. I cannot remember. There have been years when Rutgers has had a brutal start to their season in the Big Ten. The Big Ten typically does them no favors, but there is not a team in the country that has a worse 1-2 punch to start their conference season. There is no way there is any team in the country that has a worse 2-game start to their conference season than Rutgers. Home to Purdue at Michigan. Not only are Purdue and Michigan the two best teams in the Big Ten, you can make a case they're the two best teams in the country. Purdue has beaten Texas Tech. Purdue went on the road and beat a very good Alabama team. And Michigan, all they did, okay, was go 3-0 in Vegas and beat two top 25 teams, embarrassed two top 25 teams. They beat Gonzaga by 40. They beat Auburn, who just beat St. John's. They beat Auburn by 30. Michigan is a team on a mission. Purdue and Michigan are legit Final Four national championship contenders. The Big Ten hasn't won a national championship since Michigan State. They have a chance, a legit chance, to win one this year with either Purdue or Michigan, and Rutgers has to face both of them. So what's your goal, Rutgers? Your goal is to be competitive. Your goal is to have a chance in the last 10 minutes. I know those are long shots. It's likely they lose both games by 20 points. But you're trying to build something. You're trying to get confidence in your team. You're trying to build your rotation. You're trying to get some confidence offensively and defensively. You're not expected to win those games. Go in there with house money and see what happens. But then on the flip side are three very important games. And if you're Rutgers, you're thinking we have a chance in all three of those. Seton Hall in a rivalry game that Seton Hall will be favored, but funny things happen in this rivalry. Rutgers has won the last two, and they're going to try to keep the trophy in Piscataway. All right? You can't tell me that Rutgers doesn't have a shot in that game. On paper, Seton Hall will probably be favored by 7 or 8, but you cannot tell me Rutgers doesn't have a shot. Then they play Penn and Delaware State, must-win games before they flip the calendar into January and really begin the gauntlet of 18 Big Ten games. But that's what you're looking at if you're Rutgers. All right? Those last three games to end the year, if you're a Rutgers fan. Got to go 2-1. But there's a chance. If you go 3-0, then maybe you can build off something. That's the way you're looking at it if you're a Rutgers fan. All right. What a show we had. Thanks to Dave Popkin. And thanks to you for listening and downloading and sharing the Tri-State College Basketball Podcast. We have some fun. We have some teams that, you know, are showing some promise, like Seton Hall. There are other teams in this area to keep an eye out on. Monmouth, Iona, Quinnipiac, some teams that have had some nice wins, some nice results, and some teams that are trying to carry momentum into their conference play. We'll keep an eye on all of them right here on the Tri-State College Basketball Podcast. Enjoy the games, everyone. Have a great week. I'll see you next time right here on the Tri-State College Basketball Podcast.